Before I come undone, save me from the nothing I've become. Bring me to life. That's Evanescence. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jay's Talk Plus. Jay is trying to pull this out of the drain. 9-4 victory yesterday to snap a 7-game losing streak. No, it doesn't solve all that much. It does keep them from matching their longest losing streak since 2009, though. So nice to have one in the win column. A 7-run third inning. Vlad stays hot. George Springer has a 3-hit game. Bo Bichette returns. And yeah, the Jays get one back on the board, so they're not potentially coming home here for a long weekend series against the Yankees on a double-digit losing streak. We'll give away tickets to one of those Jays-Yankees games a little later in the show, by the way, as we've been doing all week. It's also NBA draft night and NBA draft week, NBA free agency, giant trade last night. We're going to talk some trades today, baseball, but unfortunately, you can't trade four unprotected first-round picks and a bunch of pick swaps. In baseball, you got to settle for, like, bringing up the Fangraphs page of some 19-year-old pitcher at low A ball or something like that. We'll do some of that over the next month if the Jays can't get this thing together. Again, last night doesn't resolve all that much, but nice to have them back on the winning side, at least for a day. Balls flying out of Fenway. Vlad with the longest home run of his career the other day. Rafael Devers with, I think it was the longest home run of his career yesterday. He just continues to crush the Blue Jays, as does Tyler O'Neill. A little bit to unpack from that one. And then obviously still the same big picture stuff we've been talking about this week and last week and really all season, as the Blue Jays sit here still 6.5 games back of the final wildcard spot in the American League. Here to break it down with us for the hour in studio in a very good shirt is Ben Nicholson-Smith. Ben, good morning. Pretty good, man. It's a chaotic couple weeks because, like, in addition to Jays stuff, obviously, and some Blue Jay Central and wanting to be down at the park, like, this is always such a fun weekend week, really, with four against the Yankees, four against the Astros around Canada Day. I got some wrestling commentary. I got the NBA draft to do stuff for. I'll be writing some NBA free agency stuff. The Scotty Barnes extension the other day that I had to write up. There's a lot going on, man. It's a busy week. It'd be really great if the Jays tacked on a couple wins so we don't have to do the same conversations for the next 2 weeks that we're going to have in late July and have been having the last couple weeks.
Yeah, it's actually interesting because I sort of feel like it shifted once they lost, 7 games in a row, because it felt like there was this holding pattern to me and they had been on this plateau, if you want to call it that, where it was sort of like, okay, they could maybe turn this around, but it's not looking so great. Then you lose 7 in a row. To me, at least, that sort of spells the end of really being a legitimate contender. Now they're very much a fringe contender. 2% playoff odds per Baseball Reference, 4.8 per Fangraphs. Like, that is out of it. They are out of it. So to me, we have to talk about this team like they're going to be a seller.
Yeah, look, the Daryl Morey rule of 5% from the basketball side is that if you have a 5% shot at a championship, you have to go for it. Not a 5% shot at the third wild card spot. And you did an AMA on Twitter the other day, and we had talked about this on the show a little bit, but you kind of put the percentages of, like, okay, if the Jays are in the, like, 25 to 50% range of playoff odds at the deadline, maybe they're a modest buyer. If they can make up that ground, maybe they're a serious buyer. And then, yeah, once you get down below 10%, not only for this front office, for any front office, you have to be realistic about this. And this 7-game losing streak, even after the win last night, has put the Blue Jays 6.5 back of the final wild card, in part because Boston is holding that spot, so you've lost ground on that team. But just as important as the 6.5 back is you would now have to also jump Texas, who did a big second-half push last year and are much better than the record suggests. Detroit, who aren't that good but at least have some solid pitching and some decent young guys. Houston, who are the hottest team in baseball other than the Mets right now and have won against lighter competition, but they've won 6 in a row and they're back to probably being modest buyers. Tampa Bay, who, even though it's a down year, we may be expecting to be light sellers, they're Tampa Bay. They're always going to hang around. And Kansas City, who have overperformed and are coming back down to earth. But again, that's 5 teams that you would have to jump, and then you'd have to knock off Boston or Minnesota. So that's why the playoff odds have crashed so dramatically so quickly, where I think when you were on last week, they were still hanging around 20%. But it's you lost these games and you lost them to teams in your playoff orbit and at a time when the other teams around you were at least hanging around 500 and some of them, like Houston and Tampa, winning a lot of games. You've got to jump. This isn't your 6.5 back of Boston. This is your 6.5 back of Boston and 5.5 back of Kansas City and 3.5 back of Tampa and 3 back of Houston and so on and so on.
it's really tough. They're in a really bad spot. I mean, I think that's pretty clear. Everyone, you know, last week when we were talking, they probably needed to win 7 in a row. Then they go out and they lose 7 in a row. And so clearly they are where they are, and it's not a good spot. So, you know, when I was kind of trying to break that down as far as what it would look like to buy, what kind of playoff odds you'd have to have, I talked to some executives with other teams and tried to get their unbiased assessment of what you might want to do in those situations. And one of the points that someone made to me was, not only is it a question of making the playoffs, but it's also, when you're making that buy-sell decision, it's also, do you have a chance to get a buy through that first round of the playoffs? Do you have a chance to be the number one wild card or win your division?
Because we've seen what can happen if you just make the wild card the last couple of years, and it's yeah, more fun than not making it, but it's not like, that's not where the goal is for this team.
No, the Blue Jays know that all too well. You can get bounced in two games if a couple things go wrong. And so this is where the Blue Jays now have zero chance. They will not have a bye in the first round. Even last week, they had no chance at a bye in the first round. So essentially, they were hoping and praying to get a chance at playing probably on the road in a wild card series. Now, even that seems to be off the table. It's not technically, it's not an impossibility, but as far as, you know, likelihoods, as far as planning practically next steps, to me, it has to be with the assumption that this team will be a seller.
Yeah, and it's a reasonable assumption, because look, it's not as if the 7-game losing streak was, hey, this team had been playing really well and, you know, we were expecting a turnaround. No, this is just, it's like you said, there's a clarity that it provides where, like, we were kind of waiting for this or the opposite, but there was a lot more evidence that they were capable of something like this than the opposite, which is going on a positive run and being back in the mix.
Yeah, and I thought that this would take until July 26th, not June 26th. And it's actually, like, it's worth saying just how stunning it is to be as a $250 million team with players like George Springer and Bo Bichette, who should be doing way more than they have been, and to be out of it in June. Like, to contend into September is no longer a goal. It's the expectation. It's the baseline. It is nothing. Like, you're contending in September. Great. So are the Reds. So are the Pirates. Like, everyone is. So, and that's September. Set aside June, right? Let alone,
you got 3 months of tickets to sell.
Well, right.
On top of, like, obviously you want to win to win, but we can be honest, this is a business that the place is not going to be that full in September, the way things are going, right?
Like, yeah, I wonder. I would think that. I mean,
you think back to the Texas series last year. Those are bad crowds.
So, and you know, they're just deflated too, and understandably deflated. I mean, I've talked to lots of Jays fans, Jays season ticket holders who are looking at this team and, you know, wow, what happened? I mean, this is a year where they were supposed to be winning, not out of contention by June. Because you look around, the only teams that are really out of contention in the American League, White Sox, A's, Angels, Jays.
Yeah.
If four teams are that are out of it, everyone else is in it. You should be in it, especially if you're spending $250. I mean, it's so obvious. I know every Jays fan knows that, and they're like, yep, obvious. Like, that's what everyone realizes, but, you know, it's worth saying, just a disappointing year.
Yeah, and look, only two teams in the National League are out of it as well, right? And like Miami, Colorado, the Angels, the Athletics, and the White Sox. If you were to come up with a list of the 10 franchises in all of North American pro sports that you don't want to be compared to, I think probably all five of those might sneak on there. Maybe the Marlins get a pass because this is, it's been bad lately. But yeah, at least four of those teams are popping up on a list of top 10 franchises you don't want to emulate or be in the same class as. So that's tough. And look, practically, the Jays probably still aren't going to sell until after the trade deadline. After the All-Star break.
Too late.
If they waited until after the trade deadline, I don't think they would get a lot back. I think they would get nothing back.
I'm going to go out and say that would be the wrong move.
Yeah, after the All-Star break. So before the All-Star break, they have one more at Boston. They'll play four at home against the Yankees, who are 52-29 and first in the AL East. They'll play four at home against Houston, who are one game under 500, but have a plus 24 run differential, are only 3.5 games back of the wild card now, have won 6 in a row against lesser competition. Then you've got three in Seattle. So Seattle's first in the AL West. They're 8 games above 500. They're 27-12 at home. That's a really good home team. And then you've got three at San Fran and three at Arizona, two teams in that National League mix where they're right around 500. They're incentivized to win right now, and they're both pretty good at home. So you've got Yankees, Astros, and then a 9-game West Coast trip leading into the All-Star break. Like, the Detroit White Sox Colorado, Oakland, like that's that part of the schedule is done. So there's not even, you know, we know we're going to wait it. They're going to wait it out because like that's what teams do. And we'll have a better idea of who's a buyer, who's a seller 4 weeks from now or whatever. But the path back to the Blue Jays not selling now seems very, very difficult. And even if they waited until after the All-Star break, like the schedule gets a tiny bit better after that. But it's like Detroit, Tampa Bay, and Texas heading into the trade deadline. And those are teams like right around you, if not a little better.
Well, and Detroit's right after the break, right?
Yeah.
So you're facing Scooble and Flaherty in all likelihood. Yeah. So it's not even like you get the easy Detroit and it's like Maeda and, you know, Reese Olson's kind of, you know, bounced around. But that's, I mean, not the point. I agree broadly with what you're saying here. And I think that, yeah, it's just, it's too far, realistically. It's just too much ground to expect to overcome. Again, technically it's possible, but we can't sit here and say that that's in any way likely. It's just too much ground to overcome. So I agree with you. The selling will happen close to July 30th, maybe the 28th to 30th. It's typically when you see those deals come together. So that's what I would expect for any seller, including the Jays, because that's when buyers get most motivated. That's when they include that extra little prospect at Class A that gets it across the finish line. So that's the priority for the Blue Jays in the next month probably needs to be, you know, you have to sort out who's making these decisions. We assume it's Ross Atkins. I don't know that that's, you know, I would presume that that's the way that they go ahead because, for you know, Mark Shapiro has shown a lot of support in Ross Atkins. So I would expect that that's the case, but that's decision number one. And then assuming that is the plan going forward, you've got to figure out what teams are to scout the most and what prospects and young players you want to try to acquire from those teams.
Yeah, and I guess there is a benefit to this clarity of purpose that this, you know, this 7-game losing streak happened now and not the 7 games coming out of the All-Star break. Obviously, they would have had to be considering this possibility, but now the path is a little more clear. You can focus a little bit more. And I know the draft's there. I've never put a ton of stock into like, oh, a front office can't focus on trades because the draft's there. Like the draft is like years worth of work.
Totally agree.
And yeah, the reason that teams don't trade early is because all these psychological biases that lead to, well, why do it now if I can wait until July 30th? Maybe the price will come down. Maybe an extra seller enters.
You just see teams play to deadlines in every single time. Like even when
and
they
every
had,
sport for the and, most part.
Exactly. Humans work to deadlines. So I'm sure you and I are no exception to that. So, you know, realistically, you really are going to see those deals happen then. The draft does not stop them. They have a very good system in place for organizing that. Whether that leads to good draft picks is another question, but they are organized enough to juggle those two things.
And yeah, the whether that leads to good draft picks, and I don't want to get too bogged down with the draft stuff, but because you mentioned a very real question, which is who is making these decisions? Because my feeling on this, and obviously we don't have perfect information in terms of who makes what decisions and how that flows, but from afar, this front office has been in charge for 8 years now, and they've done one sell-off and one build back up, and it hasn't been successful. They're very expensive. The farm system's poor. They haven't done a good job drafting and developing. The things they've done well, as you and I, we did this as an episode a couple weeks ago, they have signed free agent pitchers pretty well, which is the hardest thing probably to do with your money. And then they've done pretty well with international free agents. But everything else is a little iffy. So then you get into, you know, well, should the people who made this mess be the ones to clean it up? And obviously, changing your general manager in the middle of the season is very, very difficult. It would probably be a case of the holdovers, whether it's a Shapiro taking on more baseball responsibility, James Click taking on a little bit more, whatever. You can't do a full GM search in the middle of a season and pluck from other teams. But it is a reasonable question of if this is a lame duck situation. We thought at the end of last year, the way things went, that maybe Ross Atkins' job was in trouble. This season has obviously gone even worse. And at a certain point, like if you're the president of an organization, you do get one change of the GM, just like the GM gets one or two changes of the manager chair. I'm skeptical they'll make that change in season, but do you think this is potentially a case where that could, I guess the uncertainty of Atkins' long-term future could color, you know, what exactly they do at the deadline? And is that a concern for you?
I don't think it's necessarily a concern. I think it's a real question, and not just amongst, you know, people on Twitter. I think that even talking to executives from other teams, they're wondering what the status of Ross Atkins is long term. So, you know, he's said to be under contract through 2026. So it's not like his contract is about to expire. But you just look at the way things have gone here as you just lined up, and it's not going well for this team. So in those circumstances, that's where typically teams evaluate things. And Mark Shapiro said at the end of last offseason, they were going to evaluate everything and do a whole deep dive, right,
into the organization. By the way, and he said that in a, like, face-saving press conference, because the initial end-of-season press conferences went so poorly that Shapiro had to also speak.
That's right. And we haven't heard a lot from Mark Shapiro this season. So I expect if he does speak, he'll say that he has Ross Atkins back. As you said, teams don't typically make changes mid-season, and the Blue Jays, a very continuity, a franchise that values continuity, they might see it as disruptive to make that sort of change now. Now, does that impact the way things happen behind the scenes? I don't know, but I'm not holding my breath and thinking that there's a change coming around the corner.
Yeah, I would count, if they don't care what I say, but if they ask me, I would say going 36-43 is disruptive also.
Yeah. Exactly. The goal is to win.
How are we trying to disrupt here? Which disruption is okay? So something you said on Twitter when you were doing an AMA the other day is the question now becomes whether they can compete in 2025. And that is relevant to the trade deadline because it determines which of the players you're going to sell and maybe also what you're looking for back. Are you looking for a player who has some major league potential now with some control? Are you looking to restock a farm system that continually ranks in the bottom 10? And if that means they're further away and you've got to swing for upside, then you've got to do that. Where are you in terms of that? Because I think we're in agreement, and we've discussed this before, that when you are a team that has the pockets to spend $250 million in a current environment where the all 18 non-playoff teams have a shot at the top six pick, the new lottery like really doesn't benefit long-term tanking that much, and baseball is a sport where those guys are going to take 4, 5, 6 years to get to the majors. As a big market team, you really don't need to do a multi-year bottom out, so they probably can't justify we're not going to compete in 2025 either. Are you in agreement on that, and then how does that color what you're looking for in a trade return?
So I'm in agreement that that's how it should be. And I guess I just want to slow down before like fully reaching that agreement, because I think that it's worth asking ourselves, do the Blue Jays actually have enough to compete next year? And it's such a sad question because of the reasons you outlined. And, you know, it's like Vlad and Bo, and you have other good players too. Like, how are we having to ask this question? But I do think before proceeding and just assuming that, yes, they're going to compete next year, it's worth asking. So, I mean, do you think that they have enough to compete?
I mean, I think if you can't find your way with a $250 million budget to compete in a league where, again, 24 teams right now out of 30 have a real shot at the playoffs here on June 26th, I think you have much deeper problems than just the roster.
Which they do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I did crunch some numbers on what next season looks like. So let's assume if we play out a scenario where they trade the pending free agents, but that's it. So that would be Kikuchi, Jansen, Turner, Kiermaier, Garcia, Richards. Trade or you let them walk in free agency. And then I have also non-tendered Meza and Swanson in this scenario because those guys are $3, $4, $5 million have double-digit ERAs in AAA in some cases.
All seems accurate.
And then I did rough ARB estimates for the other guys who are ARB eligible.
Okay.
So you'd be at $190 million. For a rotation that is Bassett, Berríos, Gausman, and Yariel Rodriguez. Just four, because Manoah is going to be on the IL at least until the midway point next year. I don't think we can pencil him in. Your bullpen would be Romano, Chad Green, Nate Pearson, Cabrera, Francis, whatever other minimum guys. They're always minimum guys, but that's the core of your bullpen. And then offensively, you would have Kirk at catcher. You'd have a pretty solid infield still of Vlad, IKF, Horwitz, Bo, Ernie Clement and Aurelvis maybe as bench pieces or whoever the next guy is up from AAA. And then your outfield would be Davis Schneider, Dalton Varsho, George Springer. So you'd be at $190 million there. So based on this year's payroll, maybe you have $50, $60 million for a fifth starter, a couple bullpen guys, a second catcher, some outfield depth. That's not zero money, but you better hope some of these prospects hit in that case. So how does that color how you're thinking when I lay it out like that?
I like that. I like hearing that. I think, again, it's worth like asking that question, but I think that the answer that you're giving is yes, they can compete in 2025. If they do a reset this year, trade the pending free agents, go from there. So I'm with you.
Okay. So how then does that, and again, that was about $190 million, but I'm doing some rough ARB estimates here. So don't like, if you're aggregating, they don't like lock that in as your roster planning. So how would that then...
Speaking directly to the aggregators.
Yeah.
I like it.
Not even aggregators, because like this isn't obviously isn't reporting. I'm just like punching in a little calculator of ARB estimates or whatever.
Blake's playing 3D chess out here.
Yeah.
He's ready.
So, I mean, it's not a bad starting point, but it's very similar to this year's roster. And then, yeah, you'd have maybe $50, $60 million to spend if payroll stays the same. So if we agree then that given their payroll and who's under contract, they should probably be able to compete in 2025, at least for a playoff spot. Yep. I don't think that core we just outlined is competing with Boston with Baltimore and the Yankees.
Don't think the Yankees are too scared when they listen to this pod. Tell you that.
I don't think so.
But still, yeah.
But as far as competing for a wild card spot and getting in there, how does that then, if we're checking the box of yes, they're going to try to make the playoffs again in 2025, when you're talking about a return for Kikuchi, a return for Jansen, lower than that, you probably can't get too picky with like what you're getting back for Turner or Jimmy Garcia or Trevor Richards. Like you're getting...
Well, Jimmy, I would actually disagree.
I mean, he's once he gets healthy,
yeah,
we'll see.
Yeah.
But I'll wait till he's thrown off a mound.
Sure, sure.
Because like we're also running up on time here, right?
Yep.
Where like he hasn't even thrown off a mound yet, and we're 4 weeks out from the deadline.
I think as long as he gets out there with 1 week remaining,
yeah,
they're good.
Okay.
He'll have big value.
Okay. So when you look at what those guys could return, what are you prioritizing? Are you just prioritizing get talent in the system because you can't predict these things and you need prospects that you can trade from and things like that? Or are you looking more, hey, you should target guys who, if they're not in the majors already, are higher levels of the minors, might contribute next year, that kind of thing?
So I think with, as you said, it almost varies by player. And I think that if you're talking about Kiermaier or Turner, right, veterans who could help a contending team, maybe it's an everyday role, maybe it's just a part-time role, you know, where Kiermaier's a fourth outfielder off the bench, really helping defensively late in games, and he's a veteran presence. Okay. At that point, the return's not big.
I mean, it could just be getting out of the salary.
Exactly.
Or if you eat the money, it's...
Could have long-term benefits, yeah, which we can get into another day. But so let's say you shed some money and you get like a flyer back for Turner or for Kiermaier. That's all you're really getting. For Jansen, I think you get what you can get. I don't think it has to be a certain position or even a certain level. It's hard to say, too, with catchers. Like, the Cubs, if they can get back into this, would really be a good fit for Jansen, but they're kind of out of it.
You try to get Miguel Amaya back, then catcher for catcher?
Who knows? The Padres could probably use Danny Jansen. I just think you get the talent you can get. Doesn't matter if it's a 17-year-old. Doesn't matter if it's a 26-year-old who's out of options. Like, you just get talent.
He's going Ethan Salas mode.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I don't think you're getting that for Danny Jansen. But yeah, and then with Garcia, with Kikuchi, I actually think like with those two pitchers, you're going to try to get multiple players back. And I think that you can. I think that for Garcia, it's probably two prospects. For Kikuchi, it could even be three, like one centerpiece and a couple flyers. I don't think that's out of the question. When you're looking at someone who, along with Garrett Crochet and Jack Flaherty, is probably going to be the most coveted pitcher available this trade deadline.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Garrett Crochet has control and upside and things like that. Maybe you rank him a little higher, but like, Jack Flaherty was a very underwhelming deadline addition last year, and like he's been better. I don't think he's better than Yusei Kikuchi, though. Like,
yeah, it's an interesting debate. I could be persuaded either way on that one. Flaherty's been really good, but I think I probably would rather have 98 from the left side. But Flaherty's been really good.
Yeah, and then Flaherty, this is like, it's one of those funny things where like teams will be like, well, he's more valuable because he's pitched out of the bullpen before and we can move into that role. But the reason he's pitched out of the bullpen before is because he wasn't that good.
Yeah.
So then you get into, I don't know, but yeah, 292 ERA, you're going to have a market for that.
And the strikeout to walk. I mean, Flaherty's walking no one.
Yeah, I got to dig in further on what exactly has happened there to like cut your walk rate in a third and then also spike your strikeout rate. I don't, without like a noticeable jump in the quality of your stuff.
His location's been better.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Sure. But like we went from like a 12% walk rate to like a 4% walk rate and missing way more bats. Like without like the stuff, like no uptick in velocity, pitches aren't breaking more. It's weird. It's a funny one. But and the Tigers are a good organization for getting more out of their guys. So
no doubt. And all of that to say, maybe Yusei Kikuchi is the number one, you know, rental starter available, Crochet being in a different category. So yeah.
Kikuchi certainly has the best quality, and I don't mean stuff plus the metric. I just mean like, so it was 96, 97 from the left side, has two nasty breaking balls.
And he's throwing it for strikes.
Yeah.
And this is a guy who can pitch out of the bullpen, as you said, feels his position well. Like he does a lot of things that you want to have on a baseball team.
Yeah. So in terms of, comparables, the the starting pitching market is always, like, last year was kind of a, like, the returns weren't all that high for guys last year, but it was also, last year was just a really weird trade deadline overall. So they ended up getting Cesar Prieto, Zach Showalter, and Drew Rahm, the Cardinals did rather, from the Orioles for Jack Flaherty, which is okay.
That's
and
nothing.
But if you're looking for a Jimmy Garcia comparable, the Jays gave up Adam Klofenstein, who's now in the major leagues, and Semer Barsa, who's a pretty nice, like, those are two pitching prospects that you would have slotted in of like, oh, they're AAA starters, they're potential major league depth as soon as next year. Like, that would be a really good return for Jimmy Garcia.
That is the comp, I think, too. Like, if he comes back and he's healthy for a couple weeks before the trade deadline, I think that's a fair comp. I know Hicks was younger, but you're still talking about 2 months of an elite reliever, 2 months of an elite reliever. So to me, it's actually a really fair comp.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's a fun one. And then I went through some of the other comps from last year, and it was such a mixed bag with starting pitching. Like, it really is hard to find comps because, like, Jack Flaherty was, like, maybe the closest, but he was so bad last year. And the Cardinals were just kind of like, we'll go for, I guess, quantity over quality. There was the Eduardo Rodriguez potential, but he turned down the trade request. There was the Justin Verlander one that also required so much money being eaten, though. So, like, you can't really do that as a comp when there's not $60 million involved. And I guess, like, Michael Lorenzen was, like, kind of a pseudo bullpen guy at that point. It was a tough offseason to then look at this offseason or this trade deadline and be like, oh, that's the one for one comp to Yusei Kikuchi.
Right. And I mean, even if you look at the Blue Jays history as opposed to the broader MLB history from last year, you could look back to 2017. Probably the best trade Ross Atkins has ever made was acquiring Teoscar Hernandez for Francisco Liriano. That's the dream. You get a core player for a rental pitcher. Or you can look to the very next year when they traded Jay Happ away. They got kind of scraps, right?
They did the Cardinals approach, which was like, just give us a couple guys who we could plug into the majors.
Brewery and McKinney, and, you know, it wasn't really worth it. So, you know, you can whiff, you can have big hits. This is a big opportunity for the Blue Jays to get some real value. And I don't know if you want to get to this now or later, but I think that where it shifts to trying to acquire something a bit more specific is if the Blue Jays do listen on Bassett or Gausman, then you need to be getting pitching back. Yeah. Whereas if it's Jansen, yeah, sure, it could be a pitcher who's 17. It could be an outfielder who's 25. It's more about just improving the organization.
Right. Whereas if you're giving up Bassett or Gausman, you're removing from that 2025 rotation. You probably need someone who could slot into that 2025 rotation. And yes, you would have the $20, $22 or whatever to go spend, but I don't think you're getting a starter as good as Chris Bassett in the 2024 winter for $22 million. Like, no. Chris Bassett over the last 10 starts is like going to win a Cy Young while winning zero games.
Yeah.
It's pretty remarkable. But yeah, maybe that's where you tell the Orioles, like, if you want a guy like that, then, you know, Cade Povich has got to get on the table, or whoever, you know, whatever
great
pitching
comp.
Prospect you
that's
like.
That's a great comp.
You like a little better.
I think that's the exact type of pitcher that Jay should be looking to acquire, because Cade Povich, he's a good pitcher. He's a major league pitcher, but yeah, it's not overwhelming, right? It's not 98.
Yeah, the Orioles aren't hanging up on you.
No, exactly. You can have that conversation. So the other thing is, looking ahead to this offseason, at this point, the Jays are not going to be as desirable a destination. Let's face it, right? Like Justin Turner, Kevin Kiermaier, the veterans that you were able to land on these one-year deals, well, you know, whether they should have done that is another question, but it was a desirable place to play.
Yeah.
That might be slightly less so this winter.
Yeah. It's a good point. And like, we hear the guys say good things. Obviously, guys are always going to say good things while they're with the team. But we have heard that, you know, over the years, this franchise does treat players and their families well and things
they
like that.
They legitimately do.
But yeah, it's one thing if you're coming off two playoff appearances and a feeling that you're like right there and just missed versus, oh, we had to bottom out because if you sign here on a one-year deal, veteran guy, there's a chance we're trading you at the deadline. Like, I'm sure Turner and Kiermaier are probably competitive enough and things like that, that they'll be fine with it. But you don't really want to send that signal to like guys with families and stuff like that.
No.
Of like, hey, if in June things aren't going well, you might get rerouted for 3 months. It's a real factor.
And that would be the case next year as well. Obviously,
it will be even more aggressive next year, depending on, you know, what happens with the two key guys there in Bo and Vlad. When you look back, and you mentioned this a little bit, we looked at some comps there. Marcus Stroman would be another comp where they got Anthony Kay and Simeon Woods-Richardson. Stroman had an extra year of control in that situation. Didn't end up mattering because of the COVID year and everything like that. But at the time, it was 1.5 years of Marcus Stroman. So you were able to get Simeon Woods-Richardson was a top 100 prospect at the time. I think Anthony Kay had fallen off. But either way, and then you turn Simeon Woods-Richardson around into Jose Berríos,
yep.
which is
you're fine with that.
Pretty good work there. Yep. But when you look at the 2017 to 2019 teardown that the Blue Jays did generally, are you, and it's worth noting, this was the same front office, and it was guys that they had inherited. So they might, who knows if they feel a little bit more attached to some of these guys because they're their guys. Danny Jansen isn't their guy. He's been in the system since like 1947 somehow. But like a Kikuchi is their guy. A Turner's their guy. What lessons do you take from the way they handled 2017 to 2019? Or what lessons do you think the front office would have taken from that?
I will choose to answer the first part of your question and not the second because I honestly don't know. As far as the lessons that I would take from that, when you look back, and one of the examples is Josh Donaldson, right? Who was an MVP, and they got Julian Merriweather for him, who was a reliever that they ended up...
A player to be named later that eventually was Julian Merriweather.
To me, the lesson there is don't wait too long. If you have a really good offer, take it. Don't try to get a perfect offer. Getting something now is better than waiting. And I think part of the reason the Blue Jays are where they are this year, I mean, there are a ton of reasons for it. Some of it is player performance. Some of it is, you know, the lack of power on this roster. Some of it's the lack of depth. You look at this season, I think they were slow to make changes. I think they were slow to move Springer out of leadoff. They were slow to move Springer out of, you know, the regular playing time mix. And I don't think you want to be slow. I think you want to be ready to move. So if AJ Preller or Jerry DePoto calls you up in 2 weeks' time and it's a little before, it's a little ahead of schedule, if the offer is good enough, just do it. You know, don't wait until July 30th just because you can. If you have a good offer, take it, because I think the Donaldson lesson is there is a cost to waiting too long.
Well, this is the thing, right? It's like if there's an offer right this second for, we'll use Danny Jansen as an example. There's an offer right there. There is the potential over the next month that team, say the Padres want him, the Padres fall out of the playoff picture. The catchers the Padres are playing right now turn it around and start hitting better.
Higashioka, he's on a heater.
The Padres go out and get a catcher from somewhere else. Danny Jansen gets hurt. There are all these possibilities, and I know you might think you can get like 5% more, 10% more if you grind it out, and that is probably true in some cases, but it's not like you can't. And like this is where it being a relationship business comes in, is like, yeah, some teams might think you're bluffing if you call and say, look, I got a deal for Danny Jansen from AJ Preller right now. I'm going to move him. This is your chance. Some teams might think you're bluffing, but some teams might not if you've done a good job maintaining those relationships with other GMs and stuff like that. Like everyone has the guy in their fantasy league who's lying about that stuff. And then everyone has the guy who's like, wait, why didn't you tell me that guy was available? Why didn't you shop him around? There are, you know, AJ Preller is kind of the standout example. On the other end, you probably have DePoto in Seattle who like, I know Mariners fans have been joking a lot about like this team overperforming and DePoto is going to have to like begrudgingly buy at the deadline and be so mad about it. But who knows, maybe that's a case where a GM like that, who has generally been risk averse, even though it sounds kind of counterintuitive to make a move early, does it because he thinks the prices will go up by July 30th.
So to me, that's the lesson, is you need to be ready if you're the Blue Jays to make a move, honestly, in 2 weeks' time. And again, I think it'll take until July 30th because the offers generally aren't that good this time of year. But I think you've got to be ready. And I think that, you've got to make a move too soon as opposed to too late. What would you say to that question?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been in favor of making moves earlier if you can. Like I think I've said this when the Jays have been buyers, when they have an obvious need in the bullpen or a fourth outfielder last year with like a right-handed outfielder who could hit for power. Like we don't know all the sellers, but we know right now some of the sellers. And if the Jays were in a better situation, like say the Jays were 5 games better in the standings right now, I would be advocating that they should be looking for bullpen help right now, because the bullpen's in triage situation, right, rather than waiting until July 30th when maybe it's cost you a couple games. Like the games, like I understand the market forces, but I have never really understood why teams will sacrifice, hey, we're going to be a worse team for 30 games to delay making a move we know we're going to make in July anyway. Like that part of it has always not sat well with me.
Yeah, 30 games is a lot. You know, if that makes a difference of even one game in the standings at the end of the year, you look at how clumped up it's going to be. that makes a difference.
Yeah, and like maybe it doesn't make a whole, but you think of it, a 5-win player, say, and that's not a bullpen arm, that's like a big player, but a 5-win player is about a win a month.
Yeah.
Over the course of a baseball season, right? Like it would be every 32 games they're worth a win. So I don't know, man. I don't know why everyone, I know why, but I don't agree with why everyone drags it to the last minute. Okay. So the price is set, 4 unprotected first round picks, a bunch of pick swaps for Mikal Bridges. That's what you're leveraging off of if you're trying to negotiate with the Blue Jays. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll take a look. We didn't talk about last night's game whatsoever. We'll take a little bit of a look at it, look ahead to the rest of the week here, and continue talking some of this higher level strategic stuff. Also have unanswered questions from your Twitter AMA for you. Ben Nicholson-Smith sticks with us as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Breaking down the top stories in the NHL every day. The Jeff Merrick Show. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Did not realize the wait before the drop in that Evanescence song was so long. Sorry for the pause there. Ben Nicholson-Smith still with us in studio. In the second hour, we'll have Levi Weaver of The Athletic, Patrick Dubuque of Baseball Prospectus, and we'll give you some Jays Yankees tickets for this weekend, as well as setting up tonight between Cutter Crawford and Yariel Rodriguez. The Blue Jays did win last night, and Ben, in winning, they avoided their longest losing streak since 2009. That was a 2009 Blue Jays team that was not particularly good. I'm curious as to how well you remember them. Okay. So the 8-game losing streak, the last time they lost that many in a row, was a 9-game losing streak. Late May 2009.
Okay.
They lost 3 at Boston, 3 at Atlanta, 3 at Baltimore. That included, by the way, a 1-0 loss where a starter pitched very well and took a hard luck 1-0 loss. And a 12-10 game in 11 innings where in the 11th, they scored 2 runs and then gave up 4 in the bottom of that 11th inning. My question for you, late May 2009, big losing streak.
Yeah.
Can you name the pitchers who would have started
those
games?
Oh, my goodness.
It's bad.
Oh, wow. So I think Burnett was on the Yankees at this point.
Yeah, no Burnett.
So no Burnett. So, oh, my goodness. Okay. Was Dustin McGowan still kicking around?
Not in this 9-game set, at least.
Okay. Was Sean Markham still kicking around?
I believe he was in the bullpen at this point.
Okay. Oh, man.
So you're looking at two of them were by the ace, the guy who you can guess took the 1-0
loss. Wait, was Halliday?
Halliday was there
for
2 of them.
He was still there. Okay.
Yeah.
So, okay.
One of them eventually became the closer.
Eventually became the closer.
Not Sean Markham. The other starter turned closer from that era.
We'll come back to that one.
Okay. One of them was, I don't know, friend of the show.
Ricky Romero.
Yeah, there you go. He started one of them. One was a spectacled lefty who became a reliever later.
Brian Tallett?
Oh, Brian Tallett started 2 of them.
Okay.
There was another glasses as lefty who became a reliever later.
Chacin?
No. Brett Cecil.
Oh, okay,
a lot of guys.
Brett Cecil.
Yeah. A Canadian.
Scott Richmond.
Yep. Okay, there's 2 left. One is the guy who eventually became the closer.
Jason Fraser?
No. Jason Fraser was the closer at this point because BJ Ryan was having such a bad year that he'd been moved out of leverage.
Give me another hint.
I don't know. He became the closer. I don't know what else to tell you, man.
Okay, tell me who it is.
Casey Jansen.
Oh, nice.
And then the last one is a confusing one because the Blue Jays acquired someone else later who was very, very good for them as a pitcher who had the same name.
Okay, so they acquired someone who was good later. We'll say common name.
In recent years.
In recent years.
Cy Young and then let him walk.
Robbie Ray.
They had a guy named Robert Ray start one of those games in 2009.
Man, that was tough. I got to admit, I did not do very well there.
That is Brian Tallett twice, Roy Halladay twice, Brett Cecil, Robert Ray, Casey Jansen, Scott Richmond, Ricky Romero. You can tell why they lost nine games in a row. In addition, in the first game of that losing streak, Kevin Millar hit a home run. Okay. In the last game of the losing streak, Aaron Hill hit a home run. Nobody homered in the seven games in between.
Wow.
That was the year that Travis Snyder had just been demoted back down to the minors. It was Vernon Wells's really bad offensive year. Jose Bautista was still kind of a fourth outfielder type. I mentioned BJ Ryan had been taken out of leverage. It was bleak, man. That was a bad
tough
stretch
times.
Bad stretch of play.
Yeah. It's, you know, it is sort of useful and interesting to look back at some of those teams and think of like the hope that surrounded some of those players, only to have that hope like disappear. Or in some cases, like a Brett Cecil, have like a really good career, just not the one that maybe we thought he would have.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's one of the other things about if you have starting pitching depth that you can call on, they're not always going to stick as starters, but I'd rather a starter fail and then become a reliever than the only guys I could reach to in the minors already be seventh inning guys at Double A. By the way, Ryan Burr hit the IL yesterday along with Hagen Danner. So in addition to the Jays bullpen being very, very thinned out right now, all their AAA guys are hurt too. And yeah, so let's, I mean, we've got 9 minutes left in this hour. So let's do a little bit on the game last night. Vlad was born to hit in Fenway.
Yeah, he sure looks good there. Sure looks comfortable.
Three homers and two doubles over his last five games overall. Hit the 471-footer. A career 1.054 OPS. And probably most important, obviously this is just a five-game blip or whatever, but he had really been struggling hitting high velocity so far this year. It's something he did well with earlier in his career. He did not have an extra base hit against a four-seam fastball until this last stretch. He's got a bunch of them since, including a big hit last night off of like 97 from Brian Baio. I mean, again, we're not going to do the whole the team is fixed, this is their path back to playoff contention necessarily, but like things certainly look a little better when Vlad's hitting like this.
Yeah, it looks way better. It's you know, you look at the problems they've had this season and you can pin it on Bo, you can pin it on Springer. You can't really pin it on Vladdy. I mean, he's having a good year. It's not the 40 homer year that I think still would have been a reasonable expectation for him at this point, given that he had 48 at age 22. But at the same time, this is a really, really good major league player. I actually think, like, maybe it's this offseason. You know, it's probably not during the season, but you probably want to have a real extension talk with Vladdy. Before he gets to market, you probably want to do everything you can to say, what would it look like to lock this guy up?
Yeah, and I don't think it's 10 years, $300 anymore.
No, it is.
I hope it's not really
particularly. Well, the Jays just wouldn't do that.
Yeah, and I don't think anyone would. Like, look, there's a scenario where they can't find middle ground on it and Vlad does a bet on yourself next year, takes the 25 mil or whatever he'll make in arbitration and then says, you know what, I'm going to see if I, because if he had a walk year having hit 40 again, you know, I don't think 10 years, $300 million for a first base slash DH is going to be there necessarily. But like we've gone over the comps before of guys who, or with Arden of guys who, you know, that player type who figured it out a little later, a David Ortiz and Edwin Encarnacion, guys of that ilk.
Right. And maybe, you know, the 48 homer power, maybe that was a bit more of a blip. But you remember who he tied for the lead in home runs that year was Sal Perez?
Yeah.
And I actually wonder if Sal Perez is actually sort of a comp for Vladdy, where it's like really, really good hitter, you know, really, really good. Like you really want Sal Perez on your team, right? And you have for like 10, 12 years. Is he Miguel Cabrera or Albert Pujols? No, but maybe that was an unrealistic comp for Vladdy to begin with. And if your comp is someone like Sal Perez, like you could do a lot worse.
Yeah. The caveat being Sal Perez has played a lot of his career behind the plate where the defensive and replacement level value is significant.
And he's probably going to Cooperstown. And, you know, Vladdy came here with that kind of hope surrounding him. And I think understandably so, when you look at his dad, when you look at the exit velos, when you look at the age to level that he was at coming up.
He debuted in the majors at 20.
I still think he has some more MVP type seasons, and who knows, maybe he hits free agency as a first base slash third base, you know. Stranger things have happened.
I mean, yeah,
he looks okay over there.
Yeah, I mean, he's turned four ground balls into four outs, which is best on the team, obviously.
Best case scenario.
He's looked better there than Addison Barger, even though Addison Barger has one of the best arms I've ever seen.
Well, and to be fair too, Vladdy last night, you know, talking about that game, that play behind him in right field,
although
that
Springer,
was not good.
Springer did take the blame for it after he said, I kind of let Vladdy down there. The ball tends to drift here to right field. That's completely on me. I should have called him off and didn't. Like, I think Vlad needs to make that play. But also, yeah, Springer taking the lump for it is probably fair.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Springer, that's a nice thing by him to do. He's being a good teammate in that moment and probably should have come in and called Vladdy off. But end of the day, you're a big league player. Yeah. You have to catch that pop-up.
Yeah, you do. And, yeah, anyway, it's not been the best couple of games defensively for the Blue Jays or the Red Sox, man. Like, the Red Sox have been fun. The base stealing's cool. It's great that, like, it's not great as a Blue Jays person, but it's great as a baseball person that, like, some of the young guys have clicked and stuff like that. Is there defense too? Like, what do you, I guess I just want your opinion on the AL wildcard picture right now, where Houston has gotten hot, Tampa Bay's hanging around, Boston's been good. But, and then obviously, because we're talking about who's competing for the second and third wildcard, all these teams are very flawed. Like, do you buy the Red Sox as a playoff team?
I see them as like a fringe playoff team. You know, in a world where the Diamondbacks and the Marlins made it last year, everyone talks about the Diamondbacks. Let's not forget the Marlins made the playoffs last year. So I'm not going to sit here and say that the Red Sox can't make the playoffs, right? The Marlins made it. Yeah, the Red Sox can. I think in that picture, and you alluded to this before, but the team that's most intriguing to me out of all those American League clubs is Texas, where you have Scherzer who's back. You have Molly coming back. You have DeGrom coming back maybe in another 5 weeks. You have Cody Bradford on the way. Like, and guys like Adolis Garcia just haven't reached their full potential this year offensively. So I think Texas is a team that could really go off.
Yeah, and the issue, as we laid out off the top, and why the playoff odds are so low, is that you're not chasing one of these teams. You're chasing all of these teams and trying to fight them all off, which is why it's so difficult. Okay, before we end here, Ben, you did an AMA with your readership on Twitter the other day, and there were some unanswered questions, including you got asked, if you weren't writing about or podcasting about baseball, what would it be?
Yeah.
And one of the things you said was you maybe have like a lifestyle pod of like travel tips or things I care about now that I didn't used to.
That's right.
And I am curious what would make like the first couple episodes of a podcast like that. What do you care about now that you didn't used to?
Okay. So this would be like one episode and I would just go down a list.
Okay.
So it would be like maybe how organized like my cupboards are.
Oh, so we're going like real.
Yeah, like granular.
Okay.
Granular.
Okay.
Like I didn't used to care about that at all. And now for some reason I like it when like my drawers are organized. Or like, do I use the stuff I have? Like I didn't used to care about this. I would just have stuff that I didn't use. Now I want everything that I have to, like I want it to have a purpose. So I just like to get rid of the stuff that I don't use. So that would be like 4 minutes. We just fast forwarded. I gave you the quick version.
Nice.
But I would play that out.
That'd You're going to live podcast a yard sale of you getting rid of the stuff that you like Mary Kondoing your apartment.
But it would be like, it would be quick. Like it would be rapid fire. It would almost be that fast. And then I would go to the next item. And then it would be like a 20 minute episode. Boom, done.
Nice. What else do we have in this lifestyle podcast? Like what are your, I mean, you're on the road as a beat writer a bunch of time. What is like a low end travel tip?
Travel tip would be, what would a travel tip be?
I don't know. It was your suggestion for one of the podcast topics.
Well, I mean, I would try to prep for this. Travel tip, get Nexus.
Yeah,
if you're crossing the U.S. border, get Nexus.
Get all your friends to get Nexus as well.
Yes.
Because it's, I will still do this, but it's a little rude of like, I'm going to go to the Nexus line. I'll meet you guys at the gate.
Got
to
do it. Carry on only, obviously.
Obviously, yeah.
You don't need these tips. You're already a pro.
Also, we're it's a little easier as men, I think, to do the carry on only because fewer wardrobe changes and accessories and things.
Have a travel like toiletries bag just packed and ready at all times.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. A go bag with a fake passport and cash of multiple different denominations.
I mean, we're not going quite that far, but you know, that's
round of ammo.
Yeah. Round of ammo. Yeah. Good luck getting through the security with that.
Yeah. All right. We've got like 45 seconds left. George Springer had 3 hits last night. I don't know. It gets his June line up to a 495 OPS. Obviously it's not much. When Dalton Varsho's back, is Springer still in there every day?
So I'll try to be concise here. If the Jays have been in win mode, then I think he needs to be on the bench. Given that the priorities are shifting, I think you probably need to use the second half of the season to see what you have in George Springer.
just get them going. Yeah. If the wins and losses don't matter as much, then there you go. And look, as much as we talk trade, I don't think anyone's taking on $50 million of George Springer right now. Ben Nicholson-Smith, thanks so much for doing this, for the travel tips. And look forward to organizing my cupboards later.
All right. Thanks, Blake.
Ben Nicholson-Smith of Sportsnet, sportsnet.ca, at the letters. We'll be back with Levi Weaver and Patrick DeBeef.
The best Blue Jays show out there, period. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Good hour with Ben Nicholson-Smith there on the state of the Blue Jays. Let's get some outside perspective on what's going on with this Blue Jays team. Let's tag in Levi Weaver of The Athletic. He writes the wind-up newsletter there every day. He has a tremendous hat on. Levi, what's up, man? How are you?
Doing all right, man. How are you? You guys led me in with Aesop Rock. This is great.
That's right.
You never let me down, Blake. I appreciate this.
I appreciate you, man. Thanks for coming on. The terrific hat. I mean, I know Wayne's World is it takes place in Chicago, but Mike Myers, obviously a Canadian legend. So we appreciate that shout as well. So I read the wind-up newsletter every day, and I know the Jays aren't the most important team in all of baseball, but it has been funny to see them pop up in headlines or subheadings every so often, and like over the course of 2 weeks go from, can the Blue Jays salvage their season, to, oh, here's the Blue Jays' latest mistake and trip up. What do you make of how this thing has gone for the Toronto Blue Jays through half a season here?
Boy, it's been really disappointing. I was reading back through some preseason predictions recently, and one of the ones that I saw was Jim Bowden, who predicted that the Blue Jays would be the first team to fire their manager because they were underperforming. And he also predicted that they would have a winning record. And so would they miss the playoffs, but just barely. And I'm like, man, if missing the playoffs just barely was underperforming in Jim's mind, whoa, this has been significantly worse than I think a lot of people expected. You know, we expected the Blue Jays would be a good team, and they just haven't been. And, you know, I wish I had a better explanation as to why. You know, part of the shift to the newsletter is that I do pay more attention to the Blue Jays, but I'm not paying as close attention as, you know, say Caitlin McGrath. So I haven't watched enough to be able to pinpoint like that one thing. That's the problem. There have been some injuries, sure, but also like the guys who are playing aren't really doing that great either. So, you know, I took a look at some of the StatCast things, and when you look at, so one of my favorite stats is xWOBA. It's expected weighted on base average. It's an extremely nerdy stat, but basically it's like, here's what should have happened based on how hard the ball was hit and where it was hit. The second worst xWOBA in all of baseball right now is Dalton Varsho. He's at 251. Isaiah Kiner-Falefa is at 14th. Their offense just isn't getting the job done. George Springer appears as if Father Time has finally checked his watch and been like, time to go, bub. You had your good time in the league, and now here we go. So it's just been a few things piled one on top of the next, and it has been way worse than I would have ever imagined for them.
And Varsho and IKF are two of the like more success stories on the Blue Jays side, right? Like I know they don't rank well by that, and that also takes into account, you know, how often you're swinging and missing and stuff, which is where Varsho gets dinged. But yeah, it's it has not been great. And you're right, the injuries that have popped up, those have popped up once things were already starting to go off the rails, and they've just made it a little harder to kind of pull it out of the drain here. So I know in the windup newsletter, there's an excerpt from Ken Rosenthal most days. You're working on those with him. How fascinated are you from just a general baseball level, the idea that, you know, this recent 7-game losing streak, the fact that the Jays are so far out of the playoff picture now and so many teams to jump to get back into it, your interest just in them if they become sellers at the deadline, you know, as you're obviously going to spend the next month doing a lot of like, hey, who should this team add? What do the Braves need? What do the Phillies need? Things like that. How fascinated are you by the Jays as sellers?
I mean, I think they've got a few pieces that would be very beneficial to other teams, right? You say Kikuchi could be a good little deadline pickup. Once Yimi Garcia is fully healthy, I think he's a guy who his results of late have looked worse than they are. But my goodness, in the month of June, he's striking out 16.5 batters per nine. I mean, he's got something there. But the big question for me, which actually I know you're the one asking the questions, but I want to get your perspective on this too. Would the Jays trade Vladimir Guerrero Jr.? Because, you know, you look at teams like the Astros, who are starting to surge a little bit. They had to eventually just cut ties with Jose Abreu, right? The Yankees, they haven't seen the production from Anthony Rizzo that they would expect to see. There are a few teams in need of kind of a first baseman who can hit the ball hard. Seems like it's the sort of market that might be beneficial to a team like the Blue Jays if they've got Vladimir Guerrero and are willing to sort of lean into something of a rebuild. For me, is the most interesting name as far as the Blue Jays go when it comes to potentially being sellers.
Yeah, honestly, it's a hard one to envision for two reasons. And one is that our read on it, at least here for now, is that a sale from the Blue Jays would be with an eye towards still being somewhat competitive in 2025. You know, lots of renovations to Rogers Center, big payroll, things like that. There might not be an appetite to bottom out. And then the other part is, you know, and this applies more to Bobichet than Vlad, because Vlad's had a solid, if not spectacular season, is just, you know, where is there enough value there? You know, the 471-foot home runs are one thing. But, you know, he's only on pace for 50 extra base hits. He's expensive as a super two, RB3 next year. You know, are you getting proper value to walk away from Vlad at 25 versus, you know, try it one more year and then try to re-sign him? So here there's, you know, it doesn't seem like people think he'd be available. But I would say that when you are this far below 500 and you are this many years into what was supposed to be a competitive window and still haven't won a playoff game, nobody is untouchable, Levi, as they probably shouldn't be.
Yeah. I mean, that seems similar to me to, you know, the Luis Robert Robert, I never know how
Robert, exactly yeah, to say yeah. his name.
In Chicago, that, you know, big name, big impressive tools, but he is also, you know, he's a little underperforming this year, and the price for him might also be kind of exorbitant for the production that the team would get. I figure today, you know, we're merging Toronto and Chicago, so I just wanted to throw that in there
with the Wayne's World cap. Yes,
keep on theme.
For those who can't see, the Wayne's World Toronto. Yeah, we got to go to Makita's Donuts and have a time here. But yeah, I think Luis Robert Jr. is an interesting comp. He's also, I find him an interesting trade piece, because if the Blue Jays were remotely good, I would be like, yeah, go get him. You know, team control through 2027 with a couple of club options that insulate you a little bit from the injury stuff. Obviously, he's only played 100 games once because he hasn't been able to stay on the field. He's having a pretty rough year so far since returning. But yeah, I'd imagine, like, I mean, you've looked at this stuff a lot. And when you consider, you know, age and upside and things like that, like Luis Robert Jr. is the best player who could potentially move at this deadline, right?
Maybe. I saw something today about, you know, would Jazz Chisholm Jr. be on the move? And different types of players, yeah. Obviously, but I think he would be an interesting one if the Marlins decide to go full fire sale. Yeah, he's right up there. And, but yeah, bringing it full circle, I still think Vladdy is the one player that I'm the most interested in. Maybe Vladdy and also Pete Alonso, although the Mets have been on a hot streak lately, they may decide to go ahead and just lean into it. Which is a little bit, you know, some sardonic humor, because last year Max Scherzer had that talk with ownership and they were like, yeah, we're not really going to try and win next year. It's going to be 2026. He's like, cool, trade me. And now the Mets have a better record than the Rangers this year. But yeah, the first base market for me is one that is super interesting. Just, you know, based on the teams that have the need for a first baseman, and then also the guys that might be available if there's a losing streak or two. So, yeah, we're careening toward an interesting deadline. And I think it's made more interesting this year too, by the fact that, like, with the expanded playoffs, you've got so many teams that are still kind of within range, you know, like, are the Giants out of a playoff spot? Like, they're the third worst team in the National League, but are they within striking distance? Like, yeah, one hot streak. If they win 8 out of their next 10, they're right back in it. So it's one of those where teams are having to wait longer to make their decisions as far as like selling goes. And I guess as far as buying goes too, like, are we legitimately in this, or are we just, you know, one of these horses and a big bunch of horses racing towards the deadline? But unfortunately, and I'm talking to a Canadian audience here, like, I feel like we're probably at that point with the Blue Jays. Yeah. I think it is time to go ahead and start considering those offers.
Yeah, and I think they are. They lost 7 in a row here. And again, it's not just the 6.5 games you have to make up. It's the 6 teams you have to jump to get back in there. So you have to, you know, 6.5 better than Boston and 6 better than Kansas City and 3.5 better than Tampa Bay. And it's, you know, it gets hard to stack all those things up. So you mentioned how no one is really out of it. Like, even the Blue Jays until this week probably could have told themselves, yeah, you know, let's ride it out and let's see where it's at over the next month. There are 24 teams within 5.5 games of a playoff spot right now. And some of this is, and I know you've kind of lamented this in the windup, like, man, the National League just like really doesn't have good teams. Like, there is potentially going to be a sub 500 team that makes the playoffs in the National League. Do you like this level of parity? Like, this is, I know from the league's perspective, this is a feature, not a bug. It increases the interest in the regular season. More teams are competitive. It does drag the trade market maybe a little bit, but do you like it?
I think I do. I feel like I'm very ambivalent about this because I see the value in, you know, June 1st, you don't have two-thirds of the league going, all right, well, let's punt this to next year. I think it's good to have the fans be interested in their team and think that there's a shot. I think it is good to help prevent tanking. I think what they did with the draft, where you can't have the lottery picks multiple years in a row, and I think all of those measures to prevent tanking are good. I mean, you remember the Baltimore Orioles going through that stretch of, like, They were out of it before spring training started. You know, why would Orioles fans care at all when their team has lost, you know, 189 games in a 162 game season? So I like that. When it comes to the playoffs, and I recognize, I say this as a guy who covered the Texas Rangers and lives in Texas, and they made it in as a wild card team last year and won the World Series. I do want to see the best. I think the regular season should matter. And I think that's the balance you have to strike, right? Like, last year's Atlanta Braves, and any team is capable of choking in the playoffs. I'm not saying you need to, like, baby them and sort of give them a free pass to the World Series. But I just think that, if a sub 500 team sneaks into the playoffs and then they're the representative in the World Series, I don't love that from a purist standpoint. So I can see both sides of it. I think probably if I had to tip one side or the other, I like it more than I dislike it, just for the points that you brought up. Like, it's good that, you know, the Washington Nationals fans can still care about their team. It's June 26th and their team's still in it. Right. So, I think I like it.
Yeah,
I hedged enough.
It's good. It makes for more a higher percentage of the games on the schedule are meaningful to both teams and to both fan bases. I do wish there was some way for, like, you know, and you could never do this because TV deals and teams need to know what they're playing for and stuff, but, like, I don't know. Like, the NBA has the play-in tournament where seeds 7, 8, 9, 10 compete for the last two playoff spots instead of just the top 8 making it. And I've always thought that there should be, like, a minimum games behind or a maximum games behind requirement where, like, if you are more than 5 games out of the 8 seed, you don't get the right to challenge to like, do the play-in. Yeah. They can't do that because of TV rights and stuff like that. But I feel similarly about baseball where, like, yeah, you should have to be within X range of the teams ahead of you to really, and you can't do that. I don't know. Maybe you give an extra game to the higher seeded team in that first round or something like that to just further incentivize. Hey, like one of the Orioles or Yankees is going to have some tough luck here, right? Like, that's just the way it's going to go. But this is a tale, like, the Toronto Blue Jays existed in the AL East in the one wild card era. That's not a new problem either of kind of that disproportionality. So I don't know. I guess it's mostly good. And it's a great point you make about the anti-tanking measures in the draft. And this is something that, you know, I maybe need to talk about more because obviously there's some segment of the Blue Jays fan base that is like, tear it down, blow it up. And I understand that, like, you can make a good fan case, certainly, and a good baseball case to doing that. I think the realities of the Toronto market and the size of the payroll they have, it's probably not going to happen. It's probably not necessary. But yeah, also, like, a multi-year, you can't repeat the Baltimore thing anymore, or at least not get right. one, like, first round, first overall pick over and over and over again anymore. So that's a good thing there. So with respect to this playoff race, you mentioned the Mets. They are 14-4 since basically you buried them. You were like, fold the Mets, blow it up. What have you made of that? Obviously, it's been a ton of fun. There's the grimace element. Pete Alonso maybe getting taken off the trade block. It's fun to see the Mets do this, yeah?
I mean, and this is sort of me as a relatively new national writer. This is the lesson that you learn, is like, you're going to get burned on things like this. And to be fair, I didn't bury them as far as like, they have no shot, their season is done. I buried them on something that I still agree on. Like, I'm standing firm on this stance, which is there is no team in baseball that is more prone to silly drama than the Mets. It feels like it just, the dumbest things come up with them. But yeah, I mean, it's been fun. I'm a sucker for any underdog at any level. So even if that's the Mets, who shouldn't be an underdog with Steve Cohen as their owner, but if they're playing like garbage the first couple months of the season, I love to see that turnaround. Like, I love the interest. I love the drama. I love the human spirit going, you know, like the plot of the movie Major League. Perfect. I am the target audience for that. So yeah, I want to see the A's go on a run and make the playoffs this year. I want their last game in the Coliseum to be like clinching the World Series and then just, you know, double middle fingers up being like, we just won the World Series, by Oakland. You didn't want this. So yeah, I think it's a lot of fun. Good for the Mets. The Subway Series right now has been really interesting because the Yankees have been really great this year and then playing like trash the last couple of weeks. The Mets have not been good this year. They're on a hot streak, and you've just got these two teams sort of passing like ships in the night. I don't think the Mets are going to be better than the Yankees at the end of the season, but it's fun. It is fun. I love the unexpected. I do not want to be bored watching sports. Also, I need to correct something that I said. I said that the Giants were the third worst team in the NL earlier. That is so rapidly shifting that I missed it. They're actually now the fifth. They have somehow jumped over the Cubs and Cincinnati in one day. So, apologies to Giants fans, who are only three games out of a wild card spot. The Cubs are only four games out, and they're the third worst team in the National League right now. So that's where the National League stands right now.
Also, the Cardinals have a worse run differential than either of those teams, and they're in a wild card spot right now. So go figure.
Why
in,
not?
In the NL. Yeah, and your point about I don't agree about the A's and Oakland Coliseum, but the Major League parallel, you know, at the end of that where Roger Dorn punches Rick Wild Thing Vaughn, because of the indiscretion with the ex-wife or whatever, but it's every Oakland fan and John Fisher. They just get to kind of lay into him on the way out. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Wait, so the last game in the Coliseum, do you know what the giveaway is?
I don't.
They're giving away replica Coliseums in an extremely throwable size. Like, somebody did not think this through.
Yeah.
Oakland fans do not. You do not hand them projectiles on the last day of the homes. Like, please don't do that if you're an A's fan watching this. Like, we don't need, all right, but I'm just like, that was not, somebody did not think that through.
Not particularly well thought through. Okay, so you are formerly a Texas Rangers beat writer. You're Texas based. That's a Rangers team that's kind of doing what they did last year and hanging around the periphery of this race. Obviously, they won the World Series last year, which was very cool. They're five games below 500 right now and 5.5 out of a wild card spot. This is kind of the AL version of the NL question I just asked you, but the Rangers have another one in them. Do they have another push back to a playoff spot in the tank here?
No, man. Max Scherzer is back. He looked good in his first start back. He went five scoreless. At some point, Jacob deGrom is going to be back. What's he got in the tank? Who even knows? But the issue with them hasn't been the pitching. It's been that their offense has been not great. Adolis Garcia has been worse than expected. Nathaniel Lowe has been worse than expected. Corey Seager was hurt a lot. Did go on a hot streak when he came back. But, you know, it's Josh Young has been injured, and they missed him, I think. But Josh Smith has filled in really well at third base. In fact, I firmly believe that Josh Smith should be an all-star. I think he's at like, I want to say third in on base. I don't know. I need to check that before I say it. But go look at Josh Smith's stats. The kid that you would not expect to really be a threat has really kept the team close to afloat. But their offense has been the problem. And I think they've got another World Series run in them? I want to say no. Do I think that they could claw into a playoff spot? Maybe. I'm not super optimistic. They have not played very well this year. So we'll see what happens when Young is back and when everybody's healthy, if that happens. One of the other things too, like going back to the conversation about the playoffs, more playoff games, extended playoffs. And you know, you see this every year where like so-and-so player has done this thing in the playoffs. Yeah, they've hit more home runs in one postseason than any other player in history, more than even Babe Ruth. Okay, well, there was just a World Series back then.
Yeah,
right. And now we've got the wild card round and the divisional round and the ALCS and the so I kind of think that, intended or no, I think that has had also the effect of like you've got teams instead of playing seven extra games at the end of the season, now they're playing 25 extra games at the end of a season. I think that how much does that contribute to fatigue the next year? I don't know. But we're seeing this in all of the leagues. We had an article just this week about like the reign of parity that we're seeing in basketball and you know, football and hockey and baseball, that like you're seeing different champions every year. And I don't have data to back this up, but is that contributing the extended playoffs? Like, it makes sense that it would be.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly that's one of the theories on the basketball side. 6 years in a row with a new champion and no defending champion has gotten past the second round. Like, some of that is parity. Some of that is the league changes quick. Some of that is, you know, when you're playing, what could it be? You know, in basketball, it could be 28 extra games. So you're talking about 33% extra basketball, a shorter offseason, stuff like that. That stuff adds up. Last one for you before I let you go here, Levi. I don't know if I'll talk to you before All-Star. It's in Texas. You excited for it? You're going to be there? You're going to host the, like, is the Athletic All-Star baseball party at Levi Weaver's place, or what's going on here?
No, they're not invited to my to my place. I need my little cozy piece where I can get away from the madness. But yeah, I'll be there. I have only been, I think, to one All-Star game, and this was before I was even covering baseball. This is when I was doing music and happened to be in Minneapolis in 2014 when the All-Star game was happening, and had a buddy hook me up with tickets. So that'll be exciting to sort of be there and get to cover the home run derby and see how that plays. I'm interested to see how that's going to look on television, because there's no chance they're keeping the roof open. And the ball flies further with the roof open in Texas, but it's going to be, I think, I'm looking at the forecast here, approximately 9 million degrees in Texas that week. So there's no chance they're going to put that with the roof open. But it should be fun. It'll be good to see everybody, and hopefully it'll be as anything else, you just want an exciting game, and hopefully it's not too boring and like 14-6 by the third inning. So,
yeah, I mean, at least that would mean there's offense though. So that's a good thing as well. Levi, man, thanks. That's so true. Hey, maybe you should throw some, I know you've been working on your mound presence. I know you've been pitching a little bit more this year. Maybe you're the home run derby pitcher, maybe.
Oh no. I am a one inning guy. Right. I could throw, and my command is not like, I don't know if you've seen, I don't want to call anybody out, but you need a pitcher that can hit that sweet spot. And if I were to hit somebody in the head in a home run derby, I'd have to crawl under a rock. So we're not gonna attempt for that.
That'd be tough. At least the velocity wouldn't be too high. Levi Weaver, man, thanks so much for taking the time out, buddy. I appreciate
it. All right, take care.
Levi Weaver of The Athletic. Make sure you're subscribed to the Wind Up newsletter over there. Get the latest around Major League Baseball from Levi, from Ken Rosenthal every day in your inbox. The Blue Jays, by the way, return home this Thursday for Canada Day long weekend to lead off their final homestand before the All-Star break. Pretty big one. They match up with the Yankees for four and then the Astros for four as well. To help kick this off, we're giving away a pair of tickets to Friday's game against the Yankees on the 28th to enter for a chance to win. Text today's code word, Friday, to 590-590. Again, today's code word is Friday. Text that to 590-590 right now for your chance to win tickets to the game on Friday, June 28th against the Yankees. This is the last day we're giving away those tickets, so make sure you text in today's code word. Next time around, I'm going to demand I get to make the code words up myself so they're a little more fun and original than Friday, which is today's code word. We're going to take a break. We're going to continue with our Wednesday show. We're going to talk to Patrick Dubuque, managing editor at Baseball Prospectus. We're going to get you ready for Cutter Crawford against Yariel Rodriguez at 7:10 tonight at Fenway as the Jays look to take a series put two on the board after seven losses in a row. It's bleak, but we'll see if we can move it in the right direction. Patrick Dubuque joins us next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Joined now by the managing editor of Baseball Prospectus, who has two different author pages at Baseball Prospectus that take you to different archives. It's Patrick Dubuque. Patrick, good morning, man. What's going on? How are you?
We've never fixed that glitch. We got to figure that out.
Yeah, morning, I was looking for an article you wrote today, and I'm like, wait a second, where'd it go? Why isn't it here? And then it's, there's a second Patrick Dubuque as well. It's it happens, man. This is how you know the content is rich and deep because you need two different places for it.
The internet is difficult. Definitely.
It sure is. Also difficult. If you are a major league pitcher and you have an upset stomach and you have to puke on the mound during a game, and then you get homered off of a tough one, man. So for anyone who didn't see yesterday, Hunter Green threw up on the mound and then Brian Reynolds later in that plate appearance took him deep. How quickly do you raise your hand in the BP like Slack or chat or whatever? Be like, I got this. I'm the one writing about this tomorrow morning. It's me.
You know, I get Tuesday nights and, you know, I feel like sometimes Tuesday is harsh, but, you know, it's almost all night games. I never get a day game to write about. But, you know, that time it was just, thank you. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. Apparently, Hunter Green has thrown up multiple times this year, and he is tired of talking about it. In the post-game interview, he was just like, I don't know why it happened. He wanted to brush it off. He said, apparently in the past it was overhydration. This time he's saying it wasn't overhydration. He doesn't know. He wants to move on. He might throw up next time. Hopefully it doesn't result in an instant home run.
But, that overhydration is an interesting explanation for it. I guess the first inning you're trying to make sure that is not the bodily function I would worry about if I was overhydrated. on the serious side of that was that Brian Reynolds homered and he extended his hit streak to 22 games now. And as you pointed out in your write up of it at Baseball Prospectus, we kind of don't get to talk about hit streaks that much anymore, both because batting average is not the first stat people mention anymore, but also like league-wide batting average is like .240. So nobody goes on hitting streaks. It's nice to have a 20 gamer to track here for a little bit.
It is surprising to me that we haven't replaced, now that walks are king and now that money balls happen, why haven't we replaced the hitting streak with the on base streak? Cause it's just as good. Like you reached base and then you don't have that situation where a guy walks three times in a game and suddenly he has one chance to get that single. It always felt kind of, you get that bad pitcher who can't throw strikes and suddenly it's the batter's fault for not getting on. We can just make it the on-base streak and, we keep having them. They're fun. It's fun to be able to celebrate these random things.
Yeah, but it makes me... Have you ever seen the movie Mr. 3000?
I have not seen that.
Okay, so there's he's going for his 3,000th hit at one point, and a pitcher just keeps pitching way outside the zone. He's like, you're not getting that hit off of me. You could do that in a hit streak scenario. Like, I'm not the guy. I'm not the guy you're setting the record off of. Here's ball four. It's nice to see one of these. Even if it should be on base streak, it's nice to see it. And the Pirates are kind of fun. I know the NL wildcard picture is a big mess here of a bunch of sub 500 teams hanging a game to four games around the wildcard picture. Do you like the Pirates at all? Do you like the fact that the NL wildcard picture is this big a mess?
I mean, no, I am, if I'm one of those people who thinks we probably should go back to four playoff spots, but then I also don't make money when there are playoff games. So I don't have MLB's incentive to just jam the postseason full of extra rounds. The third wildcard spot is wreaking havoc on baseball right now, more on the National League side than the American League side, where there are at least six good teams. But it is a mess. I mean, the Pirates are fun. Like when you have those two starters, when you have Skanes and Jones at the start of a rotation, it's always going to be fun. And man, if they made a playoff round, like that's going to be great. There's a lot of holes on that team, but there's a lot of holes on every team over there. So.
Yeah, and I guess it's nice if you're headed for being a seller at the deadline, which a few teams are, including maybe the Toronto Blue Jays, who we cover here. So I'm curious as to your thoughts on this Toronto Blue Jays season from afar. I like doing this. The way this show's been structured lately is like first hour, okay, we're going to do a Toronto-centric. We're going to break down how bad it's been. And then second hour, you know what? Let's get some national voices. Just like, what do you make of this mess here in Toronto? Jays won last night, but coming off a 7-game losing streak, playoff odds down like below 5% if you look at Fangraphs Baseball Prospectus, Baseball Reference.
Yeah, BP, we're the kind ones. We have them up at 12.
Oh, wow. Sorry.
So, yeah, I know. I feel bad about this because every time I go on the show, I'm always the guy who comes on and says, calm down. They're better than they look, and it'll be fine. And this time I'm here to say they are better than they look, and you don't have to calm down. It's too late.
Yeah, which is fair, man. And they've tried to do a couple things here, right? Like they've DFA'd a couple guys to go to some prospects. They've traded in some of their defense. You know, the identity was supposed to be all defense and a little bit offense, which I don't know. I think that's an overcorrection since like 2021. And now they've had to trade in and trade back in some of that as well. But yeah, it's probably too late at this point, 6.5 games out and with the playoff odds dwindling. When you look at all those teams in the National League who are close, the actual contenders who have some holes to fill, how interested are you in the Blue Jays as a potential seller over the next month?
Well, I think what it is, like what makes this particularly frustrating time for all of you and for me, is that June is kind of, every month is a reason to be bad in baseball. And one of the reasons why June is bad is that there's not really anything to be done right now. Like I totally sympathize with fans who want to blow it up, who want to move forward, because the one thing in sports that you don't want to do is not be moving, either up or down. Right? To be frozen in a spot. And it feels like the Blue Jays have been frozen in a spot forever, but they're particularly frozen right now. There's nothing to be done at the moment. I don't think that, don't think about selling because it's going to be a month. Like the trade deadline is 4 or 5 weeks away, and it's going to be a very slow deadline because there are so many teams in it, because there are so many teams that have to pretend to look like they're in it, even though they probably don't want to be or don't want to have to sell. Everyone's going to be frozen until probably July 26th or 7th. And so in the meantime, all you can kind of do is just hope that you get a random hot streak and get yourself into it. And you have to throw out Yariel Rodriguez and you have to throw out all these high ceiling guys and just kind of hope you get lucky. And then in a month when they don't, then you can start talking about like, all right, what are we going to do now? Because then, yeah, it'll be time to start looking at Vlad and start looking at those things.
Yeah, and Vlad's maybe a little further down the line and a bigger picture one. But yeah, your Danny Jansen, Yusei Kikuchi, Jimmy Garcia kind of pending free agent ones will be a little easier to turn the page to. You mentioned Yariel Rodriguez. You mentioned him in your write-up of last night's games that, hey, that's one of the things to watch here. And yeah, he's probably in this fifth starter spot because Alec Manoah is on the IL and because they didn't build a lot of other starting pitching depth. I know he's been a little stop start with the injuries, but I know he's also a guy that, you know, you guys at Prospectus were really intrigued by coming over from Cuba by way of Japan. What have you made of the little bit we've gotten to see of him this year?
I mean, we haven't seen anything of him this year. That's been the big problem. I was very high on Rodriguez going into the offseason. I thought that was a great signing by the Blue Jays. And I still think it is. I just think it's going to start next year now instead of this year, because this year just, it didn't happen, right? It's the same with Gausman. Sometimes guys just get hurt in spring and they don't get a chance to ramp up. And sometimes they ramp up anyway. And in the case of the Blue Jays, like with Manoah not being ready when the season started, somebody needed to pitch and they probably, if they had had the chance, they probably would have played things slower with Rodriguez and given him more time. They didn't have that time. And now he's just never quite gotten healthy. And he may not get healthy, not in time for this team, at least. And sometimes it's the same with Gausman and his shoulder. You know, Gausman wasn't going to be able to sit on a month or two while he healed up to 100% from 80. So he pitched at 80 and this is what you're getting out of him. And it's just kind of bad luck. There's not really much you can do about it.
Yeah, it's a tough one, a tough start there for him. And yeah, a back thing, I mean, it's going to linger, right? Like maybe he's young enough that it goes away, but I remember someone with another team telling me earlier in the year, this is a player in their 30s, but I asked about the status of someone's back. He's like, have you ever heard of someone having had back problems, past tense? No. You have back problems, and then it's like the old Bill James thing where, like, once you've shown you have a skill, it's yours, you own it. Yeah. It's that, but it's back problems. Obviously, Yariel's young enough that, you can maybe put that behind you. But if you're in your 30s, you start getting those back problems, whether you're a baseball player or just a regular person, you are toast. Okay.
You may as well make it your nickname at that point.
Yes. Yeah. old bad back Dubuque or something like that. Okay. So let's pivot off the Jays here. The Jays have had a bad offensive season. Only the Tampa Bay Rays have a bigger home run deficit. That is a problem unique to Tampa Bay and Toronto. What is not a problem unique to Toronto, though, is a lack of offense overall. League-wide OPS has started to climb up a little bit here in June as the weather warms up, but even relative to recent Junes, it's a little on the lower end. We're seeing the same impact in Japanese baseball, where the league-wide OPS or whatever stat you pick, home run per fly ball, is lower. You know, I'm inclined to say maybe there's like a small part of this that's climate change that we just don't have the science to capture quite yet, but probably one of the leading explanations, and I know you wrote about this in a piece called "This Baseball About to Be Eaten by Rats," which is a really great headline. How much of this do you attribute to pitching being like not only having a first mover advantage when it comes to making adjustments and tweaks and changing the game, but just being so far ahead of the hitting side, you know, in terms of what the human body can do technologically, data wise, and things like that? Like how big a chunk of the explanation of this do you think is just pitching is so good in a way that hitting can't keep up with right now?
I think that's the vast majority of it. I mean, we had our issues with the ball in the past, 10 years, and they've disappeared and reappeared depending on how much we want to feel about it. It's almost all the pitchers, and the pitchers just have more ground that they have been able to cover in their advancements than the hitters have. And part of that is also the rules allowing them to. I think defense also is kind of a subtle factor here. The baseball killed the shift, but it didn't kill the outfield shift. It didn't kill outfield positioning. It didn't kill that these players are far better at defense than they were even a generation ago. And so even the balls that are getting to play are much more likely to be caught than they used to be, which is not helping anything. But it is almost entirely the pitchers. And baseball, the article that I wrote, it was basically asking the question, like, at what point do you do something about it? Because when you do something about anything in any sport, with any rule, you create these unintended consequences. And sometimes the unintended consequences can be worse than the actual problem you were trying to solve. Say, the zombie runner in the 10th inning, which I feel like is bad for the game. In Japan, there it's bad. It's so much worse there than here. And you've got an entire league that can't hit it all anymore. They need to do something. I think with our game right now, it's not quite time to panic. We've had these situations before. It is also a problem with the hitters who are just now going all or nothing because, it's easier to hit a home run than three singles, especially when everybody's throwing 101. You may as well just close your eyes and, just hope to get lucky once. I think there's going to be need to be major changes done to solve this. People have talked about many different things, moving back the mound, moving down the mound. To me, I think moving back the walls is probably the most reasonable thing to make defenses cover more ground, and also disincentivize, raw sluggers who are just going to pop the ball straight up in the air. But you have to combine that with something else to actually help the offense, because that's just changing the offense to make it more aesthetically pleasing. But it's a situation we need to keep an eye on, it because the pitchers are going to just keep getting better. they're going to keep getting better in a way where they're going to keep getting hurt. But there will be more pitchers who are also getting better to just stand in and cheaply fill those innings. And I feel like that's what's going on around the league.
Yeah, it's a bit of a, you know, every solution that gets thrown out there, there's something else, right? Like, obviously what you're saying, if you move the walls back, outfielders have more ground to cover, we juice batting average, there are more doubles and triples, which are exciting. And then, you know, we'd probably be talking about how not enough balls are leaving the park. And, right. You know, like, look, you're right. That brand of baseball is more fun than home run or nothing. But overall, offensive impact, especially because, like, defenses would then probably get even better at positioning. And we, like, we're already at a point where the offensive output from corner outfielders is, like, the lowest it's ever been. We're just going to see three center fielders in the outfielder like the Blue Jays right. do sometimes. And it's a tough one to resolve. I guess the bigger question, and this is kind of what your article was getting at, is like, is it enough of a problem that they do need to try to come up with some sort of solution for it? Or is this, you know, a natural ebb and flow and we should be weary about tweaking too much? Where do you land on that kind of central thesis of your piece?
Right. I know how I feel, and I don't know if it's the correct answer. My answer is that I like the ebbs and flows. I like when baseball changes here and there. Enough that it causes the teams and the players to have something to think about. Like, it's boring to have baseball be the exact same baseball all the time, because then everyone's going to optimize it, and then there's going to be nothing to talk about. Right now, our offensive environment is basically 1992, and nobody complains about 1992. In fact, people tend to think of the early 90s as a nice happy time before steroids ruined the game. If 92 is what we have, that's fine. Now, we're getting to 1992 a very different way than 1992 did. 1992, people struck out twice as many batters as they walked instead of four times or whatever it is now. It's just a matter of, I think that for now, we're okay. You don't want to get to 1968. You don't want to get to a point where somebody's got a 1.2 ERA, which is literally what's happening in Japan right now. But for now, it's all right. There are aesthetic things I would like to see changed. I would like to see more balls in play. But as far as the run environment goes, we're still kind of like dangling on the edge of the cliff for now.
Yeah, it's a tough one. Yeah, not as bad as in Japan. Although, I mean, and Japan has like over-tweaked even worse than Major League Baseball in the past, where like they ruined Sadahara O's records by overjuicing right. the balls and things like that. So got to be careful here. Got to take a lesson from that as well. We're just going to bounce all over the place for the last few minutes here. I got to ask you, so you wrote about the Rockies recently, and the Rockies are good at a friend of mine who works here at Sportsnet named Eric has a kind of a maxim that if you can't be good, you should be funny. And the Colorado Rockies, the Colorado Rockies have done that. The Mets had done that for a long time, but the Mets got good now. So the Mets have played their way out of this territory. But the Rockies are like really funny, and they're funny in this organization is run poorly. They have the most, they have a completely unique ballpark that they have never figured out how to optimize, like analytically or strategically. And you know, your piece Searching for Tongo Bush or whatever the fake name was, where like even the Rockies, though, even though it's so bad and so bleak, there are still fans hardcore enough to just like hate Jake Cave. Just, hey, I don't care. We're going to win 50 games. I hate this guy. Get him off my team. He cost us Bradley Zimmer, who Blue Jays legend, 100 games with fewer than 100 plate appearances. I guess this is a terrible question, but your appreciation for a team as bad as the Rockies that is able to at least like help us create content about it, help us be funny about it. And like you pointed out, the history of sabermetrics, as at least as far as like online blogging goes, is like deeply rooted in these really bad teams. It's nice to have a Rockies and a White Sox.
It is very nice to have before the season started on our podcast, Five and Dive, I made a joke about having to watch all the Rockies games this year. And my editor-in-chief said, oh, yeah, okay, go ahead and do it. And so I have been writing about the Rockies constantly. And it has been amazing how much content they've provided me. This is a team that is basically a prisoner of their own stadium. When we say that the Rockies are weird, it's mostly that Coors is weird. And Coors seems to have the magic in it to cause anything possible to happen. And the Rockies generally are not in the beneficiary of that weirdness. They just have it happen to them. Jake Cave, hilariously, since that article where we talked about how kind of low-ceiling he has delighted the fans by basically being as demonstrative and as vocal as he could possibly be. He got in a fight with Hunter Wellstead. You know, he was threatening him, pointing at him. I joke that he is like a boy who enjoys being angry at a balloon. when the pitch clock walk-off violation, of course Jake Cabe was on third base, and yeah, he was there standing, pointing at the clock as it hit zero and celebrating wildly because he went on a technicality. It's great. They will just continue to be like you basically. It is so refreshing to have some team that is so boring that they are interesting because they are not moving the same way that everybody else is.
And of course, I'm had so entirely forgotten that they were the team Kyle Finnegan did the clock off, as we can call it here, against. No shortage of entertainment from that Rockies team. And yeah, I mean, the Kyle Finnegan thing, I think it was you that had a graph about just like how close Kyle Finnegan pushes it to the pitch clock. The Nationals are like a little better than this tier, but the Nationals are also like a neatly weird team this year too.
They kind of are. They had a run where they just basically couldn't get to 500, and every time they got one game under 500, they would lose. They were kind of the opposite of the Padres, who always find a way to be 500. They're two games over right now. It's very strange. It's these teams like the Nationals, like they're in the wild card hunt, and it does not feel like they should possibly be in the wild card hunt. Patrick Corbin is starting for this team every single time around, and they're still a playoff contender. It feels weird to use those words. I feel like we need a new phrase for somebody who's a wild card three contender. We need a separate tier.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll have to think on it. We'll name it. Although I guess like we could say that, and then the Diamondbacks go to the World Series. So you can't even make it too derogatory or dismissive. You can't call it the Seawald or something like that. You got to deal with it. Patrick, man, thanks so much for taking the time out and having some fun with me.
Absolutely, it was great.
Patrick Dubuque, managing editor at Baseball Prospectus. Make sure you're subscribed over there. In addition to all the great deeper research, they do a nightly rundown, like Patrick did last night about Hunter Green throwing up on the mound and getting a homer hit off of him immediately after. It's a lot of fun. Box score bits over there. Some box score bits from last night that we haven't really gotten to give full service to today because we've done some MLB stuff and wanted to do the deeper trade conversation with Ben Nicholson-Smith. George Springer did have a three-hit game last night. I feel like I should mention it just because, you know, obviously we've been quite negative about George Springer because he's having a very bad year and having the worst month of his entire career. Right now, you know, even after last night, the OPS in June is not even up to 500. You know, he's hitting 167 for the month, 196 for the season. And there's some bad luck in there, but a lot of it's been a struggle. You know, last night he didn't exactly destroy for those couple of hits, had a strikeout in there, got a decent piece of wood on a single off a sinker, had a very soft single off a bad changeup, and then the homer he hit was on a hung slider that maybe doesn't get out of some other parks, but at this point you'll take what you can get, and George Springer certainly would. He also you know, spoke after the game and was pretty upfront, and you can check this out in David Singh's write-up of the game over at sportsnet.ca. David's down in Boston for us. I'm glad to contribute. This has obviously not been easy for us as a team, and not easy for me. For us to have that inning there, I was extremely happy about it. And then he also went on to talk about how, despite the offense, he knows there are other ways to help a team. He's trying to play defense, get walks, things like that. But yeah, it sounds like, as you'd expect, he is wearing it a little bit with how this has gone. Maybe he would have been out of the lineup a little bit the last couple of days if Dalton Varsho were available, but Dalton Varsho has not been available. The hope is that he'll be available over the next couple of days and can avoid an IL stint. Bo Bichette, of course, returned yesterday. Jimmy Garcia throwing from 120 feet. Jordan Romano progressed back to throwing from 75 feet after that minor setback. Down on the minors, you're looking at Ryan Burr and Hagen Danner, both on the injured list right now. So if you're looking for, you know, especially after today, bullpen reinforcements, because potentially, you know, if Yariel has another short stint and they need to lean on Bowden, they're in a stretch of 17 games in 17 days. Maybe you need to do some of that back end of the bullpen churn. Brandon Eisert started yesterday, although he only went two innings. You know, there are other guys you could lean on. Ricky Tiedemann is also making a rehab start today for Dunedin, which is the latest in his path back here. Tonight It is Cutter Crawford against Yariel Rodriguez. Yariel Rodriguez's first start back obviously didn't go particularly well. It was a very short outing. He hadn't been super pitch efficient in the minor leagues on his way back, but he had been really, really good in terms of missing bats and actual results. So hopefully it looks more like that tonight against the Red Sox. The Jays have seen Cutter Crawford a little bit. Vlad has some decent career numbers off of him. Bo Bichette, IKF, and George Springer have all homered off of him in a handful of at-bats. So something to watch for there, although he has struck out the Blue Jays quite a bit and is another one of those guys who kind of, ditch the four-seam and let's get funky the way the Red Sox are doing of late. Thanks to Levi Weaver, Ben Nicholson-Smith, and Patrick Dubuque for joining us. Thanks to Andrew Adams, Amit Mann, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. We will be back to tee up the Yankee series with you 10 a.m. tomorrow.